Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 12, delivered on February 24th.
Tonight, interest rates. Before we begin that, a quick look at a very, very sad market. Was this a good day or a bad day on the street, sir?
Bad day.
This was, now, you, as I've told you, you don't say crash, you say correction, okay? We have to be politically correct these days. This was a correction. We had about 3.5% down on the S&P and the Dow, and then almost 3.25% down on the NASDAQ. It was a grim day in my own portfolio. I'm now looking at used trailers on the south side of Toledo. But now, have a look here. You can see that it was a broad-based sell-off of equities. And if we look a little bit more deeply at the S&P 500, you can see that the average volume was still less, the volume today was still less than what's average, but you can see that it was drifting, and at the end, it was heading downward at the closing bell. Now, before the opening tomorrow, you can have a look at the futures contracts and to see what the sentiment is at that point. Maybe overnight the market will calm down and the bears will be satisfied and they'll go home. On the other hand, it might be just the opposite. We might just be at the beginning of a drop, a hard drop. Now, this was not hard enough for the circuit breakers to start going off. When I say circuit breakers, as I said before, if the market goes down sufficiently in a short period of time, trading will be suspended for a while just to get everyone's emotions back in order. If when it opens up, it's still plowing downward, a second set of circuit breakers may set in, may kick, and there will be a longer timeout. No circuit breakers went off today. Which may indicate, well, it wasn't that bad, but it also may indicate that the AI programs driving the market down know where the breakers are, and they will stop short of causing a breaker to go off. They are thinking ahead of the strategists who try to control these drops. So we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, although I do have to say that I certainly took a paddling in my own portfolio, as did others too. But have a look over here very quickly, coming back over to the main screen. You can see that this was a broad-based decline across the board in equities. Now, if you look over here, you'll see that the 10-year bond took a real beating today. Price went down heavily. Now, when prices go down on debt instruments, that means interest rates are going up. That's not a good sign. In other words, the equities were sold off, and the money didn't go into buying bonds, which would have pushed their prices up. Money was coming out of bonds, too. That's a stage two flight to quality. In other words, they were getting out of stocks, risky, getting out of bonds, which are safer in general. So we would hope that they were heading over here to the metals, and we would be wrong. The metals were going down. Money was going out of equities. Money was going out of bonds, and money was going out of metals. So where does it go from there? The old saying was, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. Let us hope that there wasn't a mass purchase of rounds for a revolution or something. Just a quick look, though. You can see that there was a slight rally in crude, but that can't explain this. Let me look over here at the Nikkei. The Nikkei was down hard. The London London was no better. So, and the bourses in Europe weren't doing well. So where in the HE double chopsticks was this money going? It was certainly not going into the... You see, you know that the money is going somewhere because the prices will go up there. And I don't see anything here that really tells me where the prices were going. Even that stupid crypto crap was going down. So the question is, where in the hell did it go, all that money? It went somewhere. Well, the question is, where did it go? And I'd have to look a little bit harder at the markets to see, but it worries me when there's a black hole like this. That was what happened a couple of times before when money just vanished and we never did know where the heck that money went. And that was in very bad times that happens, possibly into the dark markets. Well, not possibly. That would be a very likely place. And finding out what's going on there, I have only limited access to what happens there, but I can see it could have been dark markets absorbing that wind of money. Well, okay. Now, the dollar was getting stronger against the yen. Interest rates in the United States going up makes the dollar stronger. The U.S. interest rates going up, interest rates are the price of money, as we will talk about tonight. And as interest rates go up, well, that means that our dollar's value is going up against other currencies. And, of course, that sounds great. Yeah, strong dollar. No, that actually means that our stuff becomes more expensive overseas and their stuff becomes cheaper here. So that means that our export industries begin to suffer under the weight of higher prices for our stuff in overseas markets. That was the whole point of why the Japanese devalued and pegged their currency at some incredibly low crap level for so many years. They were making the dollar strong against the yuan, their currency, and therefore their stuff was cheap here, our stuff was expensive there, and therefore we were exporting dollars every time we bought Chinese stuff. And hence why we run such massive trade deficits. That's not good for us right now. We're teetering on the brink of a recession. The last thing we need is for a massive industry like our export industry to suddenly have higher prices for the products overseas. That's not good. So these are grim things. Does that mean that this is the beginning of the end? Should you go out and kill yourself, or worse yet, join a commune and say, go Bernie? No. I didn't say that. I didn't not say that. But these do have political implications. A very bad economy going into an election generally is bad for the ruling party in the White House and to some extent in Congress, the majority in Congress, party in Congress. So this would have major implications if it remains. That's not for sure. Personally, I don't think this is the signal of the big correction to come. It's just a nice warning shot. Here we are waiting in the corners. This is a little taste of what will happen. If it's a major correction, look 6%, 10%. If it goes beyond 10%, well, you might want to be looking out the window to see if it's a zombie apocalypse. Enough of that. So if you were thinking of investing, again, remember that bad markets are just as profitable, if you know how to play them, as good markets. Stocks going up, certainly. You buy stocks, the price goes up, you make money. But in markets where the prices are going down or you expect them to go down, you can make every bit as much money. And that's where my positioning is right now, is swinging to bear positions so that I can profit. The explanation that is currently in favor, well, why did this market crash? It's probably not the big explanation, but that coronavirus is moving forward and it's beginning to sound more and more, look more and more like a pandemic. Is that what's causing the markets to crash? Probably not. It's a good excuse. It might be a trigger, but that's not why the markets are crashing. If a lot of people suffer and die, I mean, that's kind of good for the labor markets because prices go up for labor. You might make more money if you're one of the survivors. Oh, that's grim. Let me go on to interest rates here for a while, and then I have a surprise quiz for you, and I will do that at 7:15 so that you might even be able to get out a little early tonight and walk out in this grim, freezing weather. But let's start with a couple of things. This is about interest rates, but interest rates have something as an underlying. And I'm going to start with a really kind of a simple question that actually has a rather difficult answer to it. I've gone through this before, but I want to make sure that we are clear on this before we move forward. Let's try this. Madam, what is money? Say that again. Well, put a price on it. Well, price isn't money. Well, put some kind of value on it, maybe. You're sort of halfway there. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. You make swords, and I make apple pies. If I trade you two of my delicious Dutch apple pies with a hint of cinnamon and brown sugar, absolutely always, and my crusts are flaky, and you say yes. And then I go to this gentleman. This gentleman makes, I don't know, you make battle axes. And I offer you a couple of pies for one of those ones, those Vikings in that stupid series wave around. I'm going to chop up another, church and steal all the money out of it. Yeah, real heroes those Vikings were. Okay, you accept them. So ultimately, my apple pies become money because they are becoming generally accepted in exchange for other things. And here it appears that two pies equal a sword, two pies equal a battle axe. So it's also we're getting sort of an exchange rate for these. This is natural in human and probably even in pre-human economies. We do know that early Homo sapiens sapiens were trading, and there were certain things we know were generally accepted as intermediates in trading. Specifically, we find all along these path trading routes in prehistoric times, the Native Americans were trading with certain types of flint arrowheads and cutting instruments were generally accepted in exchange for other things. How do we know that? Because these flints were from a very specific area. And apparently they were being produced, and then they were being hauled to other areas to trade for things to take back to those to other places. So we do know that. We even suspect that Neanderthals possibly had a very well-developed concept of exchange, and there were things that seemed to have been widely accepted in exchange for other things. So money sunk. Becomes sort of a natural kind of mechanism. The problem is that it's not enough to just talk about money. There are different kinds of money. Now, the oldest kind that's always been around, and understand this, once you have a kind of money generally accepted in exchange over a long period of time, it doesn't disappear. Another kind of money can show up, but it does not fully ever replace an older kind of money. The first one is the one we were talking about. It's called barter money. Barter money is physical things. Now, those pies I make, I could eat them or I could use them to trade. So barter monies are almost always fully consumable. You can use the whole thing. or you can trade it. Old monies are almost all like that. All like that. A problem with barter monies, though, is that they are not liquid. In other words, you can't immediately turn it into another asset. Remember, liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another. Barter monies are not, I have to make the pie, then I have to carry it all the way over to your condo complex, and then I have to take it over to your cave. So they're not immediately, and you might even kind of look at, kind of doesn't look as big as the one. There might be some argument there. So there is liquidity level for barter monies tends to be low. Now, the next one we saw come along were what we call metal monies. Sometimes they're called commodity monies, but that's a little bit dodgy because barter is kind of often with a commodity of some sort. It's better to call them metal monies. Now, we see those showing up, in quite ancient times. We know that the Egyptians were using metal monies. We know that some of the other civilizations in that area of the world were using metal monies. You'll see metal money showing up in the 2000 BCE era, before the current era. In other words, 5,000 years ago, we saw them showing up. Now, the problem with metal monies is that they are not fully consumable. In other words, you can't use up a little nugget of gold. It's partially consumable. You can make things with it, but you can't fully wipe it out. You ate all my pie, right? It was good. That's why you have diabetes now. So we say that they are partially consumable. Now, their liquidity is generally higher than that of barter. In other words, I could probably take a gold coin to you. Now, you might not instantly accept it in exchange for something. You might suspect that it's not real gold. You might like that, bite it. You might put it in water to see if it displaces like gold does, something like that. So it's not completely liquid. So we would call it intermediate liquidity. Now understand that metal monies, we see them very early on, but they were not fully integrated into economies. There is a fascinating story. The Egyptians were, for all the bad you might read about them, the Egyptian kingdoms, the Old Kingdom and the New Kingdoms. One thing we have found out over the many decades that we've been studying them is that they wrote down everything. They were obsessive with chronicling the stories of their existence. They would write down all of their victories and battles, but they were just as willing to write down when they got their butts kicked in fight in wars. They were blunt. And you read their writings and you will find they were sometimes unkind in their writings about their pharaohs, saying some pretty harsh things in some cases. That's why we know Cheops was hated by his people. He was an asshole. They suffered because he was spending all this money building his great pyramids, and the economy was like in a 20, 30-year miserable recession because he was blowing all the money on himself. We know that for a fact. Now, take that. They were chroniclers with another thing. the pyramids were not built by slaves. They were definitely built by highly skilled groups of artisans. There were artisans, there were little villages all around where a pyramid was being built. You had the scribes, you had the architects, and then the builders themselves were teams. They gave themselves names, just like sports teams. We know this because in the chambers of the pyramids, we find at the end of some construction phase, the logo of the construction team that did this. We were here, we got this done. And they would show the logo of a lion or a tiger or something like that. So that was, they were highly skilled. And during the reign of one pharaoh, and his name escapes me, the scribes and the architects and the engineers and the builders, they got sick of being paid so little. Now, they were never paid in coins, although the Egyptians had coins. They were always paid in booze and food and, forgive me for this, women. Okay, and so what would happen, they said, you're not giving us enough. So they went on strike, chronicled by the scribes. There was a strike, the first strike in recorded human history. They said, we're not going to work until you pay us more. Okay. The Pharaoh was of a mind, we'll just go in there and kill some of them, teach them a lesson. And his advisors said, you do that, and the scribes who are left, you know those instructions they write on how you go to wherever it is, heaven, after you die? Well, they're going to write instructions to send you someplace very bad. You really don't want to piss these people off, really. Promise you. You irritate the builders, they're going to make it so that the pyramid falls down in on itself. And after a period of time, the Pharaoh actually blinked. He said, fine, give them more of whatever it is they want. Just get the pyramid back underway again. I'm not that young anymore. Get it finished. So we have, in the absence of a more modern money, metal, or the next one after that, we have full-blown economy with labor and management fighting over wages and working conditions. You don't need fancy monies to achieve all of the liquidity, all of the things that we have in a modern economy. I'll bet you never heard that story either. Okay, the next kind of money came along. This is the odd one. Now, there are two pronunciations of that. Technically, the correct pronunciation is fiat, F-I-A-T, although you'll hear some call it fiat, which is actually the name of a brand of make of car. Okay, fiat money or fiat money. This is money that exists only by decree of a sovereign. That's the only reason it is accepted in trade, is because the sovereign says if you don't, we'll hurt you. When you look at a dollar bill, it says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. In other words, by law, you must accept it. That's the only reason it exists. And another thing about it is, have you ever tried to eat a dollar? I did once. I was hungry, okay. You know, it doesn't have what, fiber, yes. I mean, damn, that was linen. But other than that, it doesn't have any consumability. Or actually, only minimal. Only minimal consumability. Now, technically you could use a dollar, you know, for toilet paper. I actually was at a Christmas party with very wealthy people once, and I saw this very wealthy man who was holding the party actually light a dollar up, and then he lit his big, fat, stinky cigar with it. I mean, I'd never seen, I thought, he's going there. And then he just tosses it in this ashtray, and I'm like going over here, you know. But, I mean, yeah, there's a little bit. I mean, you could sort of put a bunch of dollars together and make a nice baby blanket if you wanted the kid to grow up to be a really hardcore capitalist. But other than that, I will put minimally consumable. It's there, but it's extraordinarily small. And that's actually important. But it is highly liquid. You see, okay, you see, if I drove into, let's say I go to the Red Robin, and I pull through the drive-thru, and I say I should like a double Red Robin burgers with the egg on it, and then the bacon, oh, and some more bacon, and some cheese, more cheese, you know, stack that thing up. And then I pull up the window with my apple pies and say, here, they're not going to take it. That's why I don't go to Red Robin. I stand on the outside and I look at the people inside, just mumble, yeah, you eat that burger, bro. But with a dollar, you can trade the money, fiat, because it has to be accepted everywhere. It is the highest liquidity of all. Very quickly, very efficiently, it can be turned into another asset. I can turn $5 into a decent burger. Not instantly, not bing, but very quickly. Okay, now, these are the first years. Only last year did I actually recognize there is now a new kind of money out there. New, completely new in history. See, this one goes back just thousands and thousands of years, barter. Thousands of years for metal. Fiats, they started showing up technically in the Middle Ages, metals were all over in the Middle Ages, but fiats really began to show up hardcore in the 1600s, 1700s. But even then, by decree of the sovereign, that was 19th century, maybe 20th century, that really bit in hard. This one, very recent, the newest kid on the block, the cryptos. The cryptocurrencies. A cryptocurrency has no physical existence whatsoever. Have any of you ever bought or sold anything with crypto? What's the most common name in cryptocurrencies? What is it?
Bitcoin.
Yeah, Bitcoin. But there are other ones too, of course, out there. I mean, there's a whole range of them. Even Facebook tried to create its own cryptocurrency, and everyone laughed at Zuckerberg for that. Yeah, no, you moron. You're not going to get into this. Well, he's still trying. But there are a number of cryptos out there. The most famous, of course, is Bitcoin. The thing is, it has no existence, so it has exactly no consumability. That is important. That's why I made that little concession that even a fiat has a little tiny bit of consumability. In other words, it has a little bit of intrinsic value. You see, barter money has full intrinsic value. It is a thing that can be used. My pies have full internal value. Metals have internal value, but there's also value in just the perception. This is a quick thing. Have you ever had something that was made of gold, like a gold chain or something? You haven't. Ooh. Well, if you ever did, ooh, shiny. Yeah, I've seen bars of gold. You know, they had guns nearby to kill me if I reached for them, but there's something about gold. It's just like, oh, God, that's beautiful. So there's an intrinsic inside, but there's also this aura around it. You can use gold to make things. jewelry, electronic components, all that. So there's some. But with Fiat, there's just a little tiny bit of intrinsic value. It's made with a piece of specialized paper. It has specialized inks on it. So there's something that goes into it. But with cryptos, there is nothing but electrons flowing. And electrons are just one of the classes of quantum particles. They're in the lepton class. There's no consumability. And the liquidity is extreme. It literally is at the speed of light. You can exchange one asset for another in cyberspace. And actually, that won't be the end of it. It's actually happening now with quantum entanglement, that the speed of light is no longer a barrier. If you've got full quantum entanglement, which is still really dodgy, you have two things could be happening on opposite sides of the universe at the same time because they are entangled. And that's what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. But anyway, it's just extreme, the cryptos are. So you are living in an era unlike anything that's ever come before. I'd like to say this is the end of it. There can't be anything more. But Lord knows, maybe there will be someday. I don't know. But now you're seeing the full-blown story. And notice that in any of this, in this whole bestiary, you can still see barter monies. We barter all the time. Especially, interestingly enough, when times get worse, like in recessions, depressions, you actually see the money transactions moving back toward more ancient territory. You won't pay for car repairs. You might find someone who would take, you making them a meal for a change of an oil change, things like that. That kind of barter. If someone's got metal, I mean, that's why you see metal going up when things are getting bad, is because people flow back from the fiat, stocks, bonds, stuff like that, dollar bills, they start going back toward gold coins, gold stuff, bullion, bars, and all that. So in other words, these are never going to disappear because they keep coming back, especially in more difficult times. The cryptos, you tend to suspect that they'll suffer the same fate. In very bad times, these are almost like, well, this is cool, this is fad, but when things get rough, you're going to want bucks in your pocket. And if the bucks aren't doing so well, you like to get a little gold in your portfolio maybe. And even at that, you're going to see if you can trade and transact without worrying about money in the traditional sense at all. You'll go to barter. All that is by way of starting the story of interest rates. Because interest rates are the rental rate of money. Okay, and when I say interest rates, there are lots of different interest rates, both within a country and between countries. The interest rates here are not the interest rates in Europe or Japan or China or Africa or Australia or Canada. So when I say interest rates, I probably would mean domestic interest rates as opposed to foreign interest rates. And it's those interest rate differences that drive flows of goods and flows of capital. Because in the short run, if our interest rates are high, that means that our currency is valuable. If our interest rates are more than another country's, that means our dollar is strong. That means that the exchange rate of dollars for other currencies goes up. That has a great deal of implication, as I mentioned before. If our interest rates are higher in general than those, let's say, in Europe, Europeans, by virtue of this fact, European goods will be cheaper here. because their currency is cheap. That means we will buy more of their stuff. And because our dollars are expensive, that means our stuff over there is more expensive. So they will buy less of our stuff because their interest rates are weak. Think about it this way. The Japanese were long accused of, well, the Chinese, there's no accusation. Let me use them. They were deliberate currency manipulators. They kept their interest rates stupidly low by printing huge amounts of money. Big supply of money, low price of the money. So by keeping their currency very weak against the dollar, their stuff was cheap here, our stuff was expensive there. That means that we bought piles of their stuff and exported our dollars to their bank, the People's Bank of China, to pay for them. Our stuff over there was stupidly expensive. They didn't buy anything of ours because it was so expensive. And hence, we ran trade deficits with them because we bought tons of their stuff and gave them our dollars in exchange, as opposed to they bought very little of our stuff because it was so expensive, so we got very few of their currency, called the yuan, in exchange for it. Hence why they've got literally trillions of American dollars in the People's Bank of China. Well, what do they do with those dollars? That was the whole point of it. That was the whole point. You see, our interest rates are high. They've got dollars. The only place you can spend an American dollar is in the country that made it. So they will invest those dollars that they've got in their central bank over here in our loans to the government so we can have trillion-dollar budget deficits. Yeah, the Chinese finance our excessive living. And student loans, car loans, home loans, stock offerings, bond offerings by corporations, they take care of us because essentially they have all our dollars. Well, what do they get for those? Claims on our future cash flows. In other words, they're providing us with our currency so that we can live beyond our means. And ultimately, what price are we paying for that? That's your problem because they've got claims on your future, your America. Now, interest rates, and I'll go back through this a couple of times. It takes a while for it to soak in. But once you get it in your mind, you will find out that a lot of the crap that normal people talk about, even on the news, the politicians, they have no clue about this physical dynamic process that's going on. But for now, we would talk about interest rates. And when I say that, that would be a domestic interest rate. Now, I'm going to try to stick with the books. They use capital R's and K's and things like that. Back old school, we used little R's to represent interest rates. Now, again, though, you know as well as I do, there are different interest rates. There's an interest rate on a student loan, the interest rate on a car, the interest rate on a CD that you would invest in. Though there are lots of different interest rates. We don't even call them interest rates sometimes. We call it something else. The yield, the rate of return, things like that. We use different names for them, but they're interest rates. And again, there are a bunch of them, piles of them. But they're all related because an interest rate has a structure. Inside of an interest rate is a grouping of pieces. And those are different for different kinds of loans and other investments. Think about it this way. Suppose, sir, that they do an operation on both of us. Now, we're both human beings. We kind of look the same on the outside. I look a little better, but, you know. Now, they carve us open. And at first, you know, but then they begin to recognize that there are differences, slight differences, but they are enough to make us look and behave differently. You eat things with high fiber. I can't do that. You use alcoholic beverages that would make me act really weird, and all they do is make you sleep. Things like that. I don't listen to music. You listen to Nickelback. Really? That bad, huh? Okay. Childhood can ruin you. Where the hell was I? Okay. But what I'm getting to here is that inside an interest rate are these pieces at various sizes. But there is a basis. There's like a foundation underneath all of them. This foundation, an interest rate that you would see in the real world, in the world, the foundation piece is called the real rate of return. It is the core that's sitting at the bottom. It just kind of parks there. And all interest rates are built on this thing. It has another piece to it, an expected inflation premium, which we designate as a capital pi with a little superscript e. Those two we cannot see individually. We can see them as a pair to a certain extent, but even that we can't really see. We can see it sort of. Real interest rate plus expected inflation premium is called the risk-free rate. Now, again, technically we can't see the risk-free rate, but we can see enough about it to know pretty much what its value is at any given time. Think about it this way. Some years back, and it was back in the time when I was in college, yeah, we were using stone tablets for PowerPoint, but the first photographs of molecules were starting to show up. The one that was just stunning to us back in our time, there was an actual photograph of a DNA strand, that double helix twisting with the little rungs in it. It was phenomenal. They photographed it. And then, no, they didn't. What they did was they fired a pile of photons at it, and it cast a shadow. You know, as you get back farther from a shadow, the shadow will get bigger. They did that trick, so we saw it wasn't the DNA molecule, the double helix itself, but it was its shadow cast on a surface. That's sort of the same idea that's going on with the risk-free rate. We can't see it directly, but we can see the shadow it casts and tell pretty much what its value is. When we're using this in equations, and you'll use this in an equation in a couple of weeks, we use something that is very close to the risk-free rate, something that has hardly any risk, actually almost no risk whatsoever. Typically, we use a very short-term treasury bill. That's what we use, and it is what we call a proxy for the risk-free rate, a proxy. In other words, it's approximately the risk-free rate. So we just look at a table of current yields on T-bills, and there's your Uncle Bob. As a matter of fact, I can show you right now. It has to be a short-term one, so you don't get any maturity premium, which I'll get into in the next lecture. But let me show you real quick here. And again, I don't have my bookmark, so I'll have to do this. Yield curve. Today. Now, the yield curve is actually telling us we're about to hit a recession, but I'm going to pretend that doesn't exist. Okay, right here, we would probably say the risk-free rate is approximately 1.35 or 36%. That's the shadow being cast by the actual one. Its shadow is cast as these very short-term rates. You see, the government, there's no risk in a treasury bill. The government is not going to default. You lend the government money, it will pay you back. Of course it will. Don't ever think the government's not going to default. It won't. I mean, we all it'll do, if it can't find the money from taxes, it'll just print some money and give it to you. If its printing press breaks, well, we'll just attack some country and lie about why we're doing it and take all of its stuff and liquidate it and give it to you. We're capitalists. We do that. So we're never going to not pay it. So it truly is riskless investing in a T-bill. So it is a very close shadow of the actual animal. It's not exactly, it's the shadow, but it's darn close. So the risk-free rate, we proxy by the T-bill rate. And there are some who say, well, why don't you use the 1 month? Most things we do are annualized. Our analyses are on an annual basis. Now, there's some who are saying you should use a 7-year. By the way, you see this? See how longer yields, the yields on longer debt instruments are below the yields on higher ones? Do you see that right there? That should not happen. The only time that happens is if we are about to go into a recession. Every recession has been preceded by this inverted yield curve. Now, there have been some times when an inverted yield curve did not lead to a full-blown recession. It just led to an economic pause. But this is one of the most dramatic inversions of a yield curve. Well, it is the most dramatic one I've seen in my life. My speculation would be that with an inverted yield curve, we've got 6 to 9 months until hell. That's about it. Maybe a little longer. So you'll be going into a job market that will be pretty rough. You know, I got my job, so it's not my problem. But anyway, I'm going to give you a quiz now, and then that's all I have for you tonight, and I thank you.